Hey everybody, welcome back to Radical Musings. Today I'm recording this intro from my makeshift home studio. We're still in the middle of a global pandemic. COVID cases are soaring in Southern California across the country, and I'm staying safe at home, and I hope you all are too, as much as anybody can, and wear a mask when you go out in public. It's how we protect everybody. So speaking of COVID and quarantine, I'm so lucky to have been introduced to Rabbi Mordecai Finley. He's a very well-known spiritual leader in the truest sense and meaning of the word rabbi. His guidance has been instrumental in helping me frame my perspective on this pandemic. He's taught me several techniques to keep me grounded and a lot less anxious. I was lucky enough to catch up with Rabbi Finley just a couple of weeks before the 2020 presidential election, when my anxiety level was at an all-time high. Just hearing his voice calmed me. He has a counseling practice which focuses on wisdom, virtue, and managing consciousness, specializing in interpersonal relationships. To find out more about Rabbi Finley and how to contact him, please check out rabbifinley.com. And in the meantime, listen to our conversation. But you know what? You don't have to be Jewish to love this rabbi and his teachings, because he's also a therapist, and he's just a great human being to help us navigate life in a way where we're just doing it in a kind, healthy way. Welcome to Rabbi Mordecai Finley, who is a great teacher, healer in my life and my husband's life and for many, many people's lives. And Shana Tova, because it's the Jewish New Year. And thank you so much for joining us today when it's the new year and you have so much going on, obviously, which we'll be listening to later. I wanted to start off that you are really – well, how did you become a rabbi first?
You mean
like what made you decide to become a rabbi?
Yeah. Okay, well, I had a spiritual awakening in high school. I've actually spoken about this at High Holiday Services. I had a science teacher in high school who introduced me to the what I'll call the world of spirit. He himself had studied with a great spiritual teacher named Gurdjieff, the students of Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff died in 1948, if I'm not mistaken. Gurdjieff founded schools in the United States. My science teacher studied with them, and he was always on the lookout for promising high school students whom he could induct into the mysteries. Looking back on it, it was probably not ethically appropriate. You know, I didn't get a parent permission slip or anything, but I took a class of his and he scoped me out. And I'll tell you the story. He used to, as it were, speak as a language that carried two different meanings. And sometimes when he would say the second meaning, he'd look at me. And I went to him after school one day and I said, you know, sometimes when you talk, I feel you have one message for the class and one message for me. And he said, I'm glad you noticed. I said, so what's up? So he said, well, there's other things I want to talk to you about. And we talked a little bit and I began meeting with him after school every week, all through my junior year of high school and my senior year. So I had a spiritual teacher for my last 2 years of high school. And that set me on a route.
You're more than a rabbi. You're also a therapist, a family counselor. I mean, so that's what's so great about you. And also, you're a deep thinker, super highly intellectual. And one of your best friends was Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was a member of this temple.
Yeah, he was. And I think Leonard and I listen. Leonard's known a lot of rabbis, and I think what he found in me was that depth. So, you know, when I went onto the military, went on to college, I had no sense of becoming a rabbi. I was going to go into political science, become a professor. Chose the rabbinate because I wanted to work with people's souls. I didn't want to work in a legislature. And so alongside, you know, the work of a rabbi, you know, running services and bar mitzvah classes and weddings and funerals and baby namings and so forth, I've always been a student. And I've always studied deep things. And so when Leonard and I met, you know, he found that he and I shared a life. We shared a world. So, but it wasn't because I was a rabbi. I mean, he liked it that I was a rabbi. But that it, But he met plenty of rabbis. He said, you know, you're my rabbi.
Because you talk, what I love mostly is the work that you do with couples counseling, especially has helped enormously in my own relationships in life, especially with my husband. But can you tell people what is the theory of the four C's and what your whole method is? Because it really, really is so, for me, life-changing and really important. It's helped a lot.
Well, the method is actually rooted in my experience counseling people. And I counsel very infrequently back in the old days. And one thing I noticed more and more often was that people would explode at their spouses. And I would say, well, but what's going on? And they say, well, it's what I feel. It's what I feel. And then I would say, explain to me that you get to say what you feel, but they don't. You get to unleash, but if they unleash, they've done something terrible. But if you unleash, you're just describing your feelings. So I came up with, you know, an informal 10 contrarian commandments for marriages and all relationships, probably 20 years ago. And I just kept these 10 contrarian commandments in mind. In fact, that's one of the ways I met Leonard, because when I officiated at Larry Klein and Luciana Souza's wedding, they asked me, what do you think about entertainment? And I said, you have some funny people. You don't need a band. And they said, okay, you're first. And so I formalized my 10 contrarian commandments and I presented them. They're kind of funny. And I got a big laugh. Leonard loved it. And then when I sat down, I got a line at my table of people wanting to talk to me about the 10 contrarian commandments. And so I taught my 10 contrarian commandments for a year at services. I had seminars called the 10 contrarian commandments, and it was great. I had a book going. So let me give you, I'll give you from what I remember.
Yeah.
So there is a phrase in Jewish moral philosophy called da'aga, which means worry or concern. And the idea is, be concerned with who you are as a human being much more than you're concerned about who somebody else is. Just let it take up your time. There's so many things that concern you. The outside world, the stock market, the politics, everything concerns you. Do you concern you? Does your soul concern you? Does your inner behavior concern you? So there's a book that says, Da'aga is the first thing. So I remember at the time, there's a song going around called Don't Worry, Be Happy.
Yeah.
Right? So I said, worry, be sad. Now, why? Because sadness is from another book, that a person should work around with a little bit of contrition, a little bit of sadness, that they're not using the gift of life as well as they could, mainly because they don't introspect. Again, they're so busy fixing everything out there, they're not actually looking within and asking, am I doing the best job? Am I doing it the right way? So I said, instead of don't worry, be happy, my first commandment is worry, be sad. Everybody laughed and I explained it. Okay? And so I took these kinds of things. For example, one of them was the secret to a good marriage is lack of communication. Now, I didn't make that up, but someone told it to me. And one thing I said to many couples, you guys talk too much. You know, just like say what you need to say and get out. You don't need to say the same thing every time, because most arguments of couples are the same thing every time. So I had the whole 10. And then as I tried to write the book, Rosanna, what I realized was it was a good speech, it was a good seminar, it was a good class, but it didn't really show the course of treatment. So I began to wonder, okay, I got a good seminar. But when they come to the seminar, they get the whole thing. So then I began to think, okay, what is the actual methodology? And the first methodology, and this comes from my philosophic training, is virtue. So virtue means you're not allowed to do destructive things to other people. You have to restrain. Now, virtue has many meanings, including character, etc. But the first meaning of virtue is do no harm. And our words hurt other people. That's why they get so mad. They get very upset. They get very defensive. They have to defend themselves. They feel they can't breathe because other people's words just come at us. And we feel like we're strangling, falling off a cliff. So I would see this right in front of me. I would say, okay, first of all, how about if you will take three steps back, take a deep breath, and be virtuous? They would say, what do you mean by virtue? So I started to come, well, first of all, you know, knock off with the criticism. And then after a couple of years, criticism, complaining to the person about themselves, especially with the why questions, condemning, accusing, blaming, labeling, unfairly comparing, da, da, da. And I would do that for a while. And then something would happen. And I said, okay, I'm adding a fourth C, no escalating conflict. Boom, four C's. Okay, so I had my four C's going. And I taught that for a while. And everybody who signed up and did it, their lives got better. And then I looked at the other side, the defensive person. I said, listen, they're angry. Stop explaining yourself. It does no good. And they would say, but they're wrong. And I say, hey, you know what? After three tries, it makes no difference. So I started to look at the other side. I said, you know, quit justifying yourself to an angry person. Quit explaining yourself to an angry person. Then I came up with justify, explain, defend, deny, trying to give more information to an angry person. Bad Jedi.
You call it no bad Jedi.
Bad Jedi.
No bad Jedi.
Yeah. So these things came up in, I mean, I didn't start with a theory. I started with trying to make people better. And then I found out what worked. And then I found out minimizing anger in the four C's for one type of person or both. No bad Jedi on the other. Now, I want to really emphasize here to any of your listeners, I'm not saying you can't have the feelings. I don't want to take anybody's feelings away from them. I'm not saying that in front of your therapist, you can't pour out the most vile feelings, the most angry feelings, the most toxic feelings in the world. You should work that out with your therapist. But not with your spouse and not with your kid and not with your parent, because it only makes things worse. If I thought it make things better, I'd say do it all the time. But I've never seen a case where anger, the four C's, and the bad Jedi makes things worse. It makes the person feel better because they got to unleash. It's called gratification in all spiritual schools of thought. There's the temptation for gratification. But the temptation for gratification is a very short-term gain. I feel better. I let him have it. I got it off my chest. I say, okay, now that it's off of your chest and you put it into them, now what? Because they have resentment. And they might want payback. Or they don't even like you very much. So what have you long-term gained? So this goes back to, you know, ancient schools of thought, including Hindu and Buddhist schools of thought, which has to do with put aside gratification and look for the so-called truly good. So the four C's and the bad Jedi is both guiding people away from gratification. And there's a few more steps. And then actually seeking the good.
Well, it's very helpful in my life, that's for sure. And it's constantly
working.
Yeah,
mine too.
And do you
mine
practice
too. I work.
How do you do it with your family and your wife?
Every day. Every day.
Yeah.
Every day I work it.
Will you explain it's a spiritual practice that you commit to. It's a commitment to yourself that you do it in the morning, every morning. Can you explain that process?
Yeah. Well, I, you know, soon after I wake up, I say to myself, today I may have anger, but it's my anger. I won't unleash it on anybody else. Pretty much before I get out of bed. And I say it to myself. Mm-hmm. And my wife says, who are you talking to? I said, I'm talking to myself again. Then I, you know, soon after I get up, I say, today, I will not criticize anyone. I will not complain to anyone about themselves. In general, don't complain. I won't condemn anybody. I won't accuse, blame, label, unfairly compare, contempt with gestures of eyes and hands. I just won't do it. I won't be petty. I won't be punitive. I won't engage in this escalating conflict. If I see after one or two rounds when I get anywhere, I'll just say, hey, we're not getting anywhere, and you know, go to another room and always say, look, not leave, you know, I don't have to say this, but I've said to couples, no slamming of doors, no gnashing of teeth, pulling of hair, I'm leaving the marriage, I'm getting divorced. You always say, I'll be back in half an hour. We're not getting anywhere. Now my wife also knows the rules.
Yeah.
So if she sees that I'm like really upset about something, she'll say to me, hey, we're not getting anywhere. So, you know, we're stopping and I'll be back later. I go, wow, thank you. I mean, it's a real act of grace and kindness when another person says, I won't allow this to escalate because I love you. You love me. And one of us has to not be crazy right now. So not escalating is an act of love. And then I have several more steps that I go through, you know, so I do my first, like, you know, like when I wake up, And then a little bit later, I go down to my call it my mat, my red mat where I stretch, and I do the next chunk of the daily practice, which is the insight practice. So between the two, I take about maybe 5 minutes for the first one, 15 minutes for the second one. This is not meditation. There's nothing overtly spiritual about it, although sometimes I feel God's presence. It really is higher self managing ego self. Then I might get onto more spiritual stuff. But this is really managing the ego self.
So, I mean, this really is a way, a great way of life to commit to. And I know, because of your work with my husband and I, it has really helped enormously. I mean, we're not great. Some days it's, but it has kind of seeped in now in a way that we didn't have 6 months ago. And I think quarantine has actually helped in some
ways.
Many
because people, quarantine has helped.
It's been actually hell. And then there's this other great thing that's been happening. How have you been dealing with quarantine? Because I think everybody's kind of in crisis coming to you. I know we certainly were in the first 6 months.
Well, my counseling has ticked up.
Yeah.
But it's all on Zoom.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for some people, the close proximity has unraveled people.
Yeah.
I've never seen as many consecutive occurrences of domestic violence. Not bad, but someone like pushing somebody against the wall or grabbing somebody.
Yeah.
I used to see it twice a year. Now I see it twice a month.
It's the collective consciousness. We're all, if you're an empath too, like we're feeling the fear and the news that we just are bombarded with in the state of the world. So it's like energetically, it's pretty dark. And so how do you...
As you know, I don't watch the news. I don't watch images. I do not watch... I don't even know what's on cable television.
Wow.
I don't watch... I watch movies on Netflix and stuff, but... I mean, I selectively read. If I start to read an article and I realize a person is trying to persuade me about how horrible somebody else is, I don't read it. I'll try to find someone who can actually tell me what was said and done, and I'll decide if they're horrible or not. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a few out there, but I don't want anybody ratcheting me up. Mm-hmm. I'll do that myself. But there's a lot of people in the business of ratcheting people up because they want clicks. And somebody else wants votes. Well, I'm not going to be part of their machine. I'm not a dummy, right?
Right.
So I'm going to make my own decision what's up. So that's part of it. And so what I do find is people who have the news on in the background, man, some of the most vicious fights have because the news is on in the background. You have a red person and a blue person in the same room and someone throws out a comment, aren't they stupid? Are you saying I'm stupid? Well, yeah, you are. And then boom, right?
Right.
So I say to a lot of people, turn off the TV, first of all. And number two, if you want to
listen
talk about
to podcasts.
I've listened to highly recommended podcasts, and about halfway in, I thought to myself, you can always tell when a person is debating because they leave out half the facts because they're trying to persuade the listener. So I'll be listening to a really intelligent person, and then they say stuff, and I go, "Wow, you're leaving out this huge thing." I said, "Oh, because they're trying to persuade the audience." So that's how you know when it's debate. You leave out half the facts. You build theories on an unstable foundation of facts and kind of swindle people. That's what debating is. Mm-hmm. So I just turn it off. I said, look, I know you got some good information that I don't have, but I don't want to be swindled.
Will you watch the debate? Will you watch?
Oh,
the,
no.
You're not even, you won't watch the debate of.
I don't watch the debates. They're not debates. They're just gotcha moments. I haven't probably watched a debate in 30 years.
Really? Wow.
Because they're not debates. What are you going to learn from it? You going to change your vote, Rosanna?
I'm not changing my vote at this point. Oh my
I don't think you're going to change your vote. So it's not a debate, you know? I mean, there are issues, and we may have decided, I mean, for me personally, there's a lot more importance what happens locally than at the federal level, I actually think. And so I'm very interested in the local scene. As soon as the holidays are over, I want to get involved in the local scene, all kinds of things I have in my mind. We have some of the most dedicated educators in the world in the LAUSD. All my kids went through LAUSD. I got some of these teachers very well. Mm-hmm. They want to provide a good education to everybody. Mm-hmm. But not everybody comes out with a good education. So I went down to volunteer once. I went down to my local middle school and I said, look, I have a PhD. I speak Spanish and I'd like to help. They didn't want me, you know, and one time the superintendent of schools was on KPPC, Larry Mantle. He had him on. I called him. I said, hey, I can really help. And he said, yeah, we've heard this before. That, and I said, well, what is it? And so, you know, he was Ruben Cortinas, I think he was on his way out. He said, look, I'll tell you what's up. The minute parents like you come in, you show us that certain, that we don't actually need as many teachers as much as we need retired PhDs. And that's scary for them. Hmm. He said, so part of the problem is not what's best for the kids, but what's best for the teachers. You know, either I heard it from him or somebody in the system. So I went, oh my God, I'm such a dummy. I get it. Hmm. Right. Of course they don't want me in that system. What if it become a popular guy? You know, what if I like the Pied Piper of the middle school and they all want to study English with me? That's not going to be good for them. It's good for the kids.
Terrible. That's so, what I realized, so sad it's that way. But you have a school. You have Hebrew school within your
temple. we have a Hebrew school, but you know, we do what I can, but I'm saying you and I both know that the key to it is how kids feel about them. I'm really interested in teenagers, how they feel about themselves on all levels. You know, I have two teenage daughters. And you know, they both went through the army, and we've had deep discussions about what it
feels like. In the Israeli army, right?
Yeah, both were in the Israeli army. One was in the intelligence corps, and one was in a combat medic. But they both, you know, right up, I mean, shared what it means to be in a patriarchal environment, what it means to be a woman, kind of struggling for standing, what it means to deal with inappropriate men all the time. Especially my daughter, who's on a, you know, a combat base way out in the boonies, and
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to mess with her. She could. What? She could. She did. You don't want to mess with Abigail.
Oh no, she has a blue belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. She's bona fide tough, and she went through other training and so forth. But the main thing is, what they didn't. I mean, as much as Mirav and I tried to like, you know, raise the girls healthy with a good sense of self, including teaching them martial arts. So anytime a guy was inappropriate, they knew what to do. There still is something that women go through that men don't get unless you're really close to your wife and daughters and they tell you. Hmm. So I'm very concerned with the experience of young women, and they need to be, I mean, there's a specific kind of empowerment that needs to take place, starting with the body, how you feel about yourself in your body. And then there's kids, you know, there's minority kids, and there's all kinds of things that begin at such subtle levels. I think I have a grasp on it. I mean, there's a limited amount that I can do as an old white male, but there's something I can do. Yes. I can maybe train people, and there may be some one-to-one people.
Yeah.
So I really want to make things better.
I love that idea. And that's it would be wonderful for you to do.
Yeah, thank you.
So what are the biggest challenges that you're facing personally right now for yourself?
You know, like everybody else, I've been working on this book, getting all this together. I finally finished it.
Yay! You know, oh, gosh, that's great.
I got the first draft done. So right now I'm tweaking and kind of combing it through. And then, you know, within a week, I'll hand it off to an editor. And so I got 30 more books in me. So yeah, there's that. And I'm aging. I'm going to be 66. So I really work, you know, first 2 hours of my day, I just came down from my elliptical to be with you, is working out.
Do you do it for 2 hours elliptical?
I mean, I do. Like a sitting part rest. Yeah. And then I do my agility workout on my mat, sit-ups, abs, core, all that. Then I do the elliptical. And then I go to my
jiu-jitsu.
When it opens up. Yeah. When my club opens up, I go to MMA and jiu-jitsu and all that. So a lot of it is staying vital and healthy. You know, in all my reading is the more you're active, the better you're going to age. Mm-hmm. You know, so I quip sometimes, you know, I'm as old as the youngest guy I fight. That's sometimes what my quip is. So when some big 25-year-old guy wants to go with the old black belt, I say, let's go, man, because you're going to make me young. So I'm dealing with that. Empty nesting.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, I did not know how hard that would be.
When your kids left, I never cried so hard in my life when I dropped my kid off at college. It just, like, it was so, she was like, bye. I remember when I was a kid, when Zoe was 4 and I brought her to her first nursery school and she was like, bye mama, I go to school. And all these other mothers were standing there and their kids were hanging onto their legs and they were crying because they didn't want to go in. And I was so sad, like, oh, like, my kid is not hanging on to my leg. Like, she just wanted to go. She wanted to leave. And the teacher said, no, you did a good job. Like, that means that she was felt independent and okay to go. Bye, Mama. I go to school. It was.
Yeah, exactly right.
But then when she went to college.
Remember, my eldest son was in and out. He finally moved to Israel. And then my second son joined the Marines. He was in 3 deployments, 2 wars.
Whoa.
Our third daughter went off to Israel. Far, far away. And our fourth daughter went off to Israel. First France, then Israel, far, far away. So, like, they were, like, gone. I mean, thank God for WhatsApp and Skype and all that. But, you know, when you wake up in the middle of the night, you want to just hug your kid, and they're not there, especially when my son was in combat. I mean, it was like, he was in combat, but I was going through hell. You know what I mean? I would tell him that. He says, Dad, I was the one getting shot at. I said, I know. But it's a dad's hell. You know, it's a parent hell. So working through the fact that my kids are far away, my one son lives in Israel, one son lives in Vancouver. Avigal's home for a while till her next thing, and Shuli lives in Israel, although she's home for a vacation. So what am I going through? Letting go of the kids.
Yeah.
For sure. And that's something that I think everybody around our age is going through. And, you know, no one writes about this. I think there's a book from years ago by Judith Vorch called Necessary Losses. I never read it, but I thought, well, maybe she talks about this, because I don't ever remember telling me people the hell of becoming an empty nester.
So on one hand, going to do a show called Empty Nest Syndrome, which was actually starts when the mom drops her kid off at college and meets another mom, and they get into, like, you know, crazy thing, because it really, it impacted my life in a huge way. And then, never ends.
It's a deep thing. It's a deep thing. We need to talk about it more.
I know, cause you are Jewish and you were in the army, you were in a Marine and all this stuff, but you're very fair as a human being. And it's not like you want to annihilate Palestinians. That's not where you come from.
I'm in favor of a two-state solution. I don't hate anybody.
Yes. That's really important to put out there, that there are many, many, many Jews who feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there are, you know, and on the very far other side, there are Jews that are anti-Israel and think Israel should be obliterated. So, yeah. So there's haters everywhere.
Yeah.
But listen, I went into the Marine Corps, you know, for many reasons, but I'll just share 2 that I'll share with you. One of them was, I came up during the Vietnam era, My Lai and all that. And I talked to my Jewish friends, and they said, well, you hate the army and America and the whole thing. I said, well, why don't you join up and make it better? You got such a big mouth, you know, go make a difference. Oh my God, I'd never do it. And I thought to myself, look, I was 18 and innocent. And I thought to myself, well, if I want to make the American military better, join up and do it. So I was so naive, I did it. If I want to make the military better, I will join up and be one of the guys that helped make it better.
Did you?
Okay, so yeah. I think I did. I think I made a difference. Look, especially as I gained rank. I mean, when I was a sergeant, what I could do, this is after Vietnam.
Right.
But I could correct small injustices that I saw around me because I had rank. I saved a couple of guys from terrible situations, you know, where they got in a fight or something, or got into a hassle with an officer. And I just walked up and I said, hey, Lieutenant, I'm his sergeant. I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. You know, he'll get what's coming to him. I got it from here. If I wouldn't have walked up and did that, he got thrown into the
bridge. But you didn't give him what's coming to him. Because it was very abusive, a lot of it, right? That when you went through it?
You know, boot camp was abusive. Yeah. I mean, look, boot camp was supposed to be abusive. They're preparing us for war. I would say outside of boot camp, it was strict. Mm-hmm. Very strict, more strict than you can possibly imagine. But I'll be very honest. It was fair. Mm-hmm. My best buddy was black. In fact, I lived with 3 black guys when I moved off base. If it was racist, it wasn't like white cracker Southern racism. The Navy was racist, by the way. Well, the most racist institution. The Marine Corps wasn't. The Marine Corps really was based on, can you perform? And if you could perform, you got respect. But what happened was, including my best buddy, is people would drink. Hmm. That was the biggest enemy, was drinking. So, like, I had a buddy who had a few drinks, and then he'd get into an officer, and the officers will not take anything from a junior Marine. So I'm just saying, as a sergeant, I could step in and say, Lieutenant, I got this one. Let me take care of it.
And you were never a drinker yourself?
No, never a drinker. I drank exactly once when I got to Okinawa. Exactly. I went to they call it the EM Club, the Enlisted Men's Club. Didn't like it first and last time. Yeah, the Marine Corps was a good experience. You know, if you don't drink and you don't do drugs and you follow orders and do your job well, you'll go up. There's nobody in your way.
But do you think now it's the same in America? Because really?
It's better now. Better now. I mean, my son was in for 4.5 years, and I actually, when he came back from Afghanistan, his ship that took him there, on the way back, they unloaded the aircraft squadron in Hawaii, and they invited family to come in and bunk in on their way from Hawaii to Camp Pendleton. So I flew out to Hawaii, and I came back the next 8 days. And I lived down with the junior Marines in, you know, Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 4th Marines. And, you know, what can I tell you? I asked my son about it. And one thing I noticed, they're far better trained, much higher quality of people, because you have to be a high school graduate with at least a B average, highly competent. I didn't notice any racism, prejudice, none of that. Huh. I mean, really. And I talked to guys, and guys said, it's all about competence. And I don't know anybody who would say anything different today.
Really?
And if they said it's racist, often just mean they met a racist guy.
Yeah.
But as an institution, let me just give you an example. So you would think, oh, Marine Corps, like anti-Jewish, whatever. You see, you know, they're anti-Semites. I said, look, I'm sure they're anti-Semites. But when I was in boot camp, about the third day of boot camp, the drill sergeant calls out of his duty hat and he says, can we cuss here, Rosanna?
Yeah, go for it.
He yells out, all Hebrew motherfuckers, report to the duty office. I go, what? And so we're all looking at each other. I go, all right. So I pound on the door. Sir, one Hebrew motherfucker, report to the door, sir. And he steps in and he basically told me where the Jewish services were and, you know, where to be and how to catch the bus. He says, you know, we don't have services here. We have the Navy base. And as I went out, he says, I want to tell you something. I said, yes, sir. He said, in general, a religious Marine is a better Marine, and I'm glad you're a religious Jew. I said, sir, yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Now, on the other hand, in my platoon of 80 guys, someone did call me a dirty Jewish blah, 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 and we got into a fight. Mm-hmm. Okay? He called me a name. I jumped on him. They pulled me out, sent me up to the barracks. I thought, well, I'm going to the brig now. So, but who was the sergeant of the day was our black drill instructor. So I go in, he says, Finley, going to the brig. I said, yes, sir, pack your bag. And he said, so what happened? So I say, no excuse, sir. That's what you're supposed to say. He says, really, what happened? I said, sir, well, Private McKelvin called this private a dirty Jewish motherfucker, sir. He said, why don't you kill that cracker motherfucker? I said, sir, the other private had my hands behind my back. He said, next time you kill him. I said, yes, sir. He says, okay, go back to the platoon.
So, oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, there's this one guy. And then I jumped on him. I think my drill instructor, Sergeant Simmons, wanted to give me a medal if he could. So what was it like? Look, I was a white Jewish guy. I didn't feel any anti-Semitism. My best buddies were black. And the only ones who got in trouble were the ones who were defiant, drank, and weren't with the program. And they would probably say themselves. That was when I was in. When my son was in, same thing. I can't say what the Navy, Air Force, Army is like. I can only tell you what the Marine Corps is like. By the way, I've done a lot of research on it. And, you know, while there's always anecdotes,
there's
hardly any evidence that what's the word they use, systemic. And I don't believe our military is systemically racist, because there are so many NCOs and officers of color in the military.
Well, we're certainly seeing, especially in the last months, the total disrespect for the military. And I actually never felt like, I kind of didn't care either way about the military. Oh, whatever. And then I did, you know, this thing that's been happening, especially from our president, how he's just really disrespects our military. It really bothered me.
Yeah, you know, it certainly bothers me too. But yeah, you and I have spoken about this. As a certain person, when I know that somebody is vulgar, temperamentally unfit, I don't get re-enraged every time. Mm-hmm. I just put them in the box of vulgar and temperamentally unfit. Whatever they do next, it's like they're in the box where I put them. If a person does something noble and out of character and changes, yeah, I'll let people change. But I know a lot of people get outraged and they say, what do you think that he said this? I said, I think that's the same guy from 5 years ago. That's what I think. Aren't you mad? I said, what good would it do me to be mad? I don't, what do you want out of me? You want me to be, why you want me to walk around with rage with a guy with heart disease my age? I don't want to. So
it's a choice. We choose the way we want to live in our lives. And I mean, I do, as you know, it's a big issue with my husband too. I'm very involved with news. I watch the news. I'm very enraged by it. And it does affect me, and I can't sleep at night with what's going on in our country right now.
I mean, you want to know who got disrespected? If you look at the police, you know, who are like guarding courthouses, and they're getting spit at and the finger and people screaming in their faces and they can't do anything.
Well, we don't want more knees on necks and killing black people.
That guy is at least guilty of third degree murder. But I'm talking about
Breonna Taylor. You know, like they need to be charged with murder. They shot her in her own bed sleeping, right?
She wasn't in bed, but we can talk about that later. But I'm making one point. Whatever few rogues you have, the vast majority of the footage that I've seen on, you know, like now and then I'll see a clip on YouTube or something, is they're standing there being custom spit at and they're not responding. Mm-hmm. I think that's good training. Now, there's always going to be rogues. There's rogues everywhere.
I think we got to get the white supremacists and the background checks. Anybody who has that kind of racist, you know, value system in their being cannot be a police officer. End of story.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anybody who doesn't fundamentally respect all citizens equally should not be given the honor of protecting us. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. Cause it's gotten really horrible. I kind of, you know, when I had an experience of doing a movie called The Wall about the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, a 4-hour miniseries years ago, and we actually shot in Poland, and we went to Auschwitz, so, like, I can say, I don't know how many people can say this. Like, I have been to Auschwitz 10 times. I kept going back to this place where the Holocaust really did take place, where mountains of little kids' shoes and eyeglasses and hair, like a mountain of people's hair. It's just, you never seen anything like this. And then walking into what was the gas chambers, and you can hear the voice. I could feel it so much. And I saw this picture of a girl. My family was wiped out in Poland. And I there was not a name, or there was her, just her face. It's my family. She was my family. She was my family. Even if she wasn't of my blood DNA family, she was my family. And I really had this profound experience. And another experience I had was going to Israel and being in front of that wall. And I just like stood in front of that wall and burst into tears, and it was like sobbing and like, where's this coming from? What is this? What? And so these moments, you know, where I was like, I guess I am Jewish, like, you know. And so, but I couldn't find it where it really was for me, because I have to say, I also like sometimes going to a church, like, because it's beautiful, and lighting a candle. It just feels okay to me, you know. It feels, it's not like religious, it just feels like lighting the light in spiritual. And so when I met you at your temple and your teachings and the way you speak, it just made me value and honor and love the Jewish religion in a way that I hadn't before I met you.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, we share something in that the Holocaust deeply affected me as well. I went to Israel when I was 17, had a very deep experience at the wall in Yad Vashem. I lived in Israel for a year right after the military. I lived on a kibbutz, went to Jerusalem several times. And one thing that made me sad on the kibbutz was there was no Judaism. It was, you know, workers' environment. It was socialist. It was Zionist. But there's no Judaism. They were, as it were, post-Judaism. And I remember thinking to myself, this is not workable. Because unless you're in Israel speaking Hebrew and the Jewish calendar is part of the national calendar, this is not going to keep people Jewish. And I had some conversations with people about it. And, you know, they would say, you know, they don't care about Judaism. So, you know, when I came back from Israel and began college and had that revelation, wanted to be a rabbi, one of my goals was, I think it was three. Number one, I remember how much I was transformed by boot camp. And I saw other guys, you know, go in one way, come out the other. And I got a sense that religion ought to be about transformation. It ought to be about, you know, taking the soul one place and bringing it to another, especially with virtue, consciousness, wisdom, and so forth. So I thought to myself, is there a way for there to be a spiritual training to make people wise, conscious, kind, good, etc.? That was one thing. The second thing was, because of the Holocaust, what I wanted to do, my wife and I wanted to do, was create a synagogue that would be joyous, that would make people happy, that would not try to, like, you know, kind of get involved in the ratcheting up of political ideas, but really directed toward the soul. So I'm glad to say we have a very politically diverse synagogue. I think we're exemplary in that way. But what we share is a focus on creating depth and joy. And that's been our focus. I think when you walked in, I think you, number one, saw that I'm not trying to sell you, like, keep kosher, keep Shabbos. No, no. I was trying to say, hey, there's a better way to live.
It reminded me of my childhood, because we lived in a commune when I was a kid. So there was like this thing called the lodge, a place to lodge where everybody gathered. And that's what, as soon as I walked in, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, the furniture around, just like very cozy, yeah, comfortable. Yeah. And it reminded me of my childhood. When I walked in,
my wife very much wants to make, you know, a cafe where people could sit and hang out. We don't have pews. We can organize the chairs however we want. So we intentionally wanted to create a not uptight, low key, warm environment. That was by intention. And part of it was, I want people to love being Jewish and to feel joy and safety. It's not going to sound right, but that's my best revenge for the Holocaust, is to create Jews who love their Judaism. There's nothing else I can do. I can't change that. I can fight evil in the world, but as far as from the Jewish perspective, it's, you know, repopulate with people who love Judaism. And look, I think a lot of rabbis are doing fantastic work. I mean, I'm doing like Finley's work.
You do your own way, but you also teach the Bible.
Yeah, I love teaching the Bible.
Right.
Yeah, I do a Bible class on Monday. I helped found a seminary, so I've taught almost every topic in Judaism. For about 20 years, 15 years, I helped train rabbis, and we had many rabbis there. And I think each rabbi has his or her own vision of what it ought to be. And I really believe in this pluralism. I really believe in a kind of a free market of Judaism, where each synagogue, each rabbi says, "Here's my version." And anybody should be able to find the version that speaks to them. So I'm not saying that what we do is the answer. I'm saying it's an answer. And for anybody who likes it, join in. You know, it'll feed your soul. So that's how we met. You came and you enjoyed the teaching. You came on Shabbos. You saw how happy. You liked the vibe. That's what pretty much what Leonard said, by the way, when someone said, "Leonard, why do you like it there?" He said, "It's not uptight." That's what he said. That's why he kept coming back. So you're a poster girl for Oratora, Rosanna.
Yeah. I mean, I've brought a lot of friends to hear your teaching, especially about, you know, the psychology, the wisdom and virtue classes, which are for me, really important. And you have a podcast, right?
You know, I was, thank you. I was, from my wisdom and virtue class, I recorded the first few because so many people wanted that direction in the wall of virtue. So I put those three up.
Where would people get that? So, because it's worth listening to, I have to say. It's really important. I mean, I listen to it over and over sometimes, you know, like just because I need to.
Thank you for that.
Tattoos, no.
I'm going to redo them now that I have a better mic and a better sense of what I'm after. I'm going to actually call it the name of my book, which is Good People, Bad Habits. I'm going to just do a series of 10. But if you type Rabbi Finley podcast, it's on what's called Spreaker, S-P-R, and then E-A-K-E-R, Spreaker.
Okay.
It is not well publicized. It's not where it should be on Spotify and everything else. We're just going to wait to get on the other side of High Holidays.
And when the book comes out, maybe we'll get, you know, get
it. Yeah, exactly. It'll be, the book will be at the editor. I'll redo the podcast. I'll do the right social media. We just got to get through the high holidays and kind of get back to a regular group. That's been the other tough thing is, as a synagogue, not being able to meet. because for many people, Or HaTorah was coming on Saturday, coming to classes. And since we've had to close the building, you know, we've had to just figure a different way to be a synagogue. So that's been stressful, was our staff working remote, doing, you know, putting together a remote Hebrew school. I mean, this has been, you know, it's
well, the high holidays are now, and as we speak, this weekend and everything. And I think you're doing really well.
Thank you.
And there's a lot of, we watched it last week, and it was good.
Yeah, thank you.
I have to say, I mean, it was like, okay, I'm going to admit, like I said to Todd, I said, I like going and watching the temple and from bed in my pajamas. Like, is that disrespectful?
I'm admitting it. No, not at all. Not at all.
I was like, and maybe I kind of watched it all day and it was like good and no, you know, it in my.
Listen, I don't think we're going back. I think there's going to be some number of, we're going to have to keep broadcasting. We found a great company who's going to, as you saw, with moving cameras, you know, Mirab had her iPad.
Yeah.
Mirab was the director of photography. She was saying, go here. So,
she's great.
So she was the DP.
And, great. And the music was beautiful. She's your wife, Mirab, your other half is a musician. And so the music is so beautiful. That's what I really love is also the music in their temple is like, it's hip. It's really cool. It's wonderful.
Yeah, she chooses and arranges everything. And it's really phenomenal. You know, they rehearse here in the other room, in the living room. And nice. Oh my God, it's like it's,
their voices are beautiful.
I think the angelic choir shuts up and says, "Okay, everybody, shut up and listen to them."
Yeah,
you know that. I think it's that good. But anyway, as to your point, yeah, we're not going back. What we realize is the country has gotten used to watching from home. Some cluster will want to be there on. You know, assuming we're going to get back to our building, start up Saturday services, we'll have to continue the online side.
I feel sorry for kids, though. This is hard for kids to not connect in a way. I mean, in this way, during this time, it's like there's this incredible disconnect, and then there's this deep connection. It's very strange that we're finding this whole way. Yeah. But I miss hugging. I miss being with people. I really do. And I feel so sorry for the kids right now. It's just too much. It really is.
Yeah, it's very tough. And, you know, it's very tough. So, look, with the Hebrew school, we'll have to do it online. It was hard getting kids after school anyway because they're so tired. So we're going to figure out a way to get maybe like one Sunday afternoon a month, get everybody together at the park and really hang out and hug.
Oh, that's a neat idea.
But remember, a lot of families are very happy. Hebrew school is at 4:00. I don't have to run you from school. I don't have to run home, get you a snack, run to the Hebrew school. So parents are they both miss, and I think if we can provide a social element and do that.
But that's in your community. I'm, you know, because I work really closely with Dr. Hagar of the Violence Intervention Program. We're seeing such a surge of, as you said in the beginning, a little domestic violence, and people who are not able or just can't leave their kids at home in front and can't even afford the computer to do it. And that's where we need help.
That's one of the hugest inequities that we have done in such a blasé, nonchalant fashion and never addressed it. Working people who can't leave their kids at home, and I'm waiting for the governor, the mayor, be like, we're putting out a national call. We'll run you through a registry. I would have gone to someone's house if they would have said, "Hey, my kids are gone. Let's give you a background check. You sit there, do your work, and be in my home for 3 hours." I would have gone over there. I could do my work from anywhere, right? But like, I'm waiting for the state, for the city, for the county, somebody to say, "Let's mobilize and help working people who are leaving their kids at home." And Rosanna, it's one of my greatest disappointments in our local leadership in this. The most vulnerable people, in my opinion, weren't protected the most by what, from my perspective, would have just been organizational.
Yeah.
You would have volunteered. I would have volunteered. Everybody you know would have volunteered.
Yeah.
To say, I'll watch your kids while you work. I'll do the 9 to 12 shift. Somebody else does the 12 to 3, and I'll just make sure your kids are safe and, you know, well behaved, and I'll do my work. What would have been hard about that?
So all these kids are just slipping through the cracks and missing out on an education right now, and it's really frightening.
Yeah, and that's why I think our work when this is over of catching kids back up. You know, what I hope is the opportunity to tutor, they're going to make it more streamlined and welcome people. because the couple times I've tried it, I just felt a wall went up. And I thought, well, I have so much to offer a kid, and it's as if they wouldn't let me in there. So,
oh, really?
And not the only one. Huh. I wasn't the only one.
Because of this time, because they've built this wall right now in the last eight months.
No, I'm talking about when my kids were in middle school. This back in those days when I tried.
Oh, in those days. Okay.
Yeah, but now I think after COVID, we have a huge common responsibility to catch the kids back up.
Yeah.
And so we need almost like a volunteer corps. I think it has to be run at the local level. Mm-hmm. Find the kids who are behind in whatever area, get the volunteers, vet them as quickly as possible, run background checks. And I think thousands, once libraries are open again, once churches and synagogues are open and meeting places are open, like, wouldn't that be a great way to use our space during the day?
Yes.
Is have tables all around the sanctuary filled with, kids that need some backup work. We're willing to do it. Yeah. We're ready.
And tutoring, so as soon as helping with the tutoring. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah. No, we hope that this building turns into a resource center for many things. But one of them would be a tutoring center for anybody, English second language of any age, kids who want to get caught up. We have, especially people want to run, programs for young women, for the kinds of things my daughters have told me about kind of reading situations, how to carry your body, basic self-defense. So kinds of things where, as much work as we've done, many women still feel powerless and don't know. They can say no strong and actually put an elbow behind it because they've never thrown an elbow. Sometimes when a girl comes into our martial arts studio, I'm one of the senior black belts, and I sometimes take the new person. First thing I say is, have you ever thrown a punch? And they say, no. I say, have you ever been punched? They say, no. I say, in the next couple of days, you're going to throw a punch, you're going to be punched, because you can't be a martial artist if you've never felt it, you never delivered it. At some point, I'll say, put on the gloves, and I want you to hit me, okay? And I'm not going to hit you light, right? And they go, I say, okay, now you're still alive. Now they're going like, oh, I'm going to get hit. I say, okay, you lived. So part of martial arts is you can take a punch and you can throw a punch. And some of the women who come through, they said, oh my God, I can't believe it. I've gone through my whole life. I want to protect myself. I've never thrown a punch and never got punched. So I know it may sound strange on Rosanna's Radical Musing podcast, but
no, I think if I had my daughter now, I mean, as little, I think, and I talked to your daughter Avigal about doing this, is self-defense is a prerequisite to growing up you have to learn to protect yourself.
Our daughter Avigal wants to actually launch a coaching thing for young women, and one of them is,
I love it,
walk tough, be tough, not feel bad, not feel guilty. She says there's so many things that go on, between ages 15 and 25 that messes with girls' minds, and they need
to be
tough, strong in so many ways. And she's now, she studied with me different schools of thought. She's going to launch a website, and that's her life mission, at least for the next 10 years.
I'm excited about that. I'm really. Okay.
I'll let you know when it happens.
When I came and you
were at our house, and we had a very inspiring discussion, and you said, "Let's go."
She should do that, because I think there's such a need for young girls who are being especially caught up in the internet. And, on the other side of it is some crazy person who's pretending to be a 14-year-old 100%. Girl, and they're actually a predator. And I want our girls to be able to protect themselves from that.
Yeah. When our daughters were teenagers, they got me a t-shirt. When they were kids, like in teenagers, they got me a t-shirt that said, guns don't kill people. Fathers with daughters kill people.
That's funny. Okay, well, I love digging into the why and what motivates people. And I want to know what your why is.
Well,
What you do? What compels you to do what you do?
I think I feel touched by God, first of all. I truly do. And I feel my work is to bring healing to humankind. And then I've asked myself, what's my thing? Well, one thing is I want people to calm down. And I want them to calm down interpersonally to make room for love. I want us to calm down as a nation so we can listen to each other and find a way forward. So calming down is a tactic for depth to arise. That's one thing we really haven't spoken about is I call my path wisdom, virtue, wisdom, rationality, and depth. Many people can't access depth because they're not quiet, because they don't have virtue, so they're squabbling with others. They can't figure things out because they haven't learned how to think and be rational. They don't have deep wisdom. They have opinions, but not wisdom, which are very different from each other. And then there's access to depth. And for me, depth, the realm of the soul, has at least four dimensions, as you've heard me say many times, love, justice, truth, and beauty. Below that, there's what you call the good in the deepest philosophic sense and the holy. So I'm thinking a person who can be virtuous, rational, wise, and deep is one version of a whole human being. And as I worked this out through high school with my teacher, Jack, what I saw in the military, what I saw in the kibbutz, my life as a rabbi, being married, you know, for decades, raising kids. What motivates me is human flourishing. I'll give you an example. I've been working with a couple that began, they came to me in a very bad place. I mean, things in tatters.
Was that us?
I mean, was that? No, not you guys. Oh, you guys
no, we go in and out.
If you heard this story, you would give yourself A's compared to another couple that I walked through for the past month.
Oh gosh.
And lawyers and court appearances and all this stuff. And I kind of like got them without being pushy to the point we let go of the lawyers. We let go of the stuff. We're going to both do virtue. We're going to slowly get this thing together. They thanked me. They said, we want to stay under your guidance. We want to do it your way. Your way is way better than the others. And I wanted to say, well, I paid a little bit of my rent. Okay, which is I have to pay rent for the space I take up here. You know, for how many years I'm going to be taking up space on this earth, I have rent to pay. And my rent is paid by doing good. And so when a couple says to me, you saved our marriage, you got us back together. You know, our kids are not going to grow up with, you know, absent fathers, absent mothers. And they say, you had a lot to do with it. My first thought is, well, I did what I'm supposed to do. That's my duty. So what motivates me is duty. I have a duty to bring healing to humankind. That's my duty. I'm going to do it as a rabbi. So I'll start with Jews. But as you know, it's open to everybody.
Yeah, it is open to everybody. But everybody should know. You don't have to be a Jew to come to your teachings in the temple. It's pretty incredible.
We have a large number of non-Jews come. Yeah, so that's my core thing. And so that's why you hear me kind of veering away from politics. I have strong opinions, but it doesn't make any difference because smarter than people have, you know, that's what they do for a living is develop political opinions. I like to say with what I do best, which is virtue, rationality, wisdom, and depth, I'm an expert. So I would rather spend time talking about what I'm an expert at and let other people talk about what they're experts at. Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank you, Rabbi Finley.
It's been a pleasure.
The Shana
Tova. Our conversations are always great. Yeah. So,
this was great.
Actually, this is different.
Yeah. And have it's a Jewish New Year. And wait, before you go, what is the Jewish New Year? What is the Jewish New Year for people who are non-Jews right now? Why is this time important?
Well, it's in our blessing. You know, we don't say Happy New Year. We say L'Shana Tova, which is a good year. We add L'Shana Tova U'Mituka, a good and sweet year. So we have to have some theory of the good. What's a good marriage? What's a good family? What's a good work environment? What's a good city? So when I say L'Shana Tova, a year of the good, I say to people, let's all meditate on the good and then implement it. Yom Kippur, which starts Sunday night, Monday, they call Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of this 10-day intensive. Yom Kippur is what's called the sealant. So I have this, they say gemar, which is, you know, may your year be like a seal on a letter. But I like to, you know, use the metaphor that we open up all this work, we do all this work by Yom Kippur, but we don't want it to leak out. We don't want it to dissipate. So I say Yom Kippur is the sealant. This is staying intact. This, I'm gonna build it, I'm gonna seal it, I'm gonna put it in me, and it's gonna guide me through a year. So we have a 10-day intensive called the 10 days of Teshuvah, the 10 days of turning. Begins with Rosh Hashanah, ends with Yom Kippur. The inner work, if you ask Finley, virtue, rationality, wisdom, and depth. I'm mostly focusing on depth this year because I haven't in other years. So I'm doing, as you know, I'm doing the realm of the soul at all of my talks. And by the time people are done, I want them to seal it. And, you know, hopefully I'll spend this next year keeping people awake to the process of human transformation.
Thank you, Rabbi. Okay. Thank you so much. Yeah, and I did say Happy New Year, which is, see, this is my bad.
Happy New Year's good.
It's my bad Jew thing.
No, it's colloquial. It's okay. But I'd rather people say Lashana Tova, and they'll say, what does that mean? Say, have a good year.
Have a good year, Rabbi Finley.
A good year to you and all of yours. Okay.
Okay. And I'll see you this weekend.
I'll see you soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review Radical Musings to help other listeners find the show. And subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast to be alerted every time we post a new episode. Radical Musings is brought to you by Audio Up, produced by Krista Liney and Carla Braun, edited by Jeremiah Zimmerman, production support provided by Ashley Ardent, Sam Winter, Tyler Dorson, Emma Rappold, and Richard Regal. Thank you all so much. Ooh, la, la. Audio.